Yeah,
but it's not.
Yeah, you can't. Try. Because if you can talk about it, then it must have some kind of being.
I remember, you know, back when we were in university, I was told this sort of like logical, like this like kind of thought problem or exercise, which is, you know, imagine something, like just for you do it, listeners too, imagine something that's like nothing else. And you think, oh, well, you know, when I first did it, I was like, okay, well, I want to imagine this line that's like all these different colors and it's moving all over the place. And you're like, well, that's a line that's moving all over the place with different colors.
Yeah, yeah. Okay,
so that's like that stuff. Let me try and think about something else, maybe a different shape or color or
a song lyric
that's I've never heard before. Mm-hmm. But again, all these things, they are things and they are definable in some way.
Yeah, they're analogous to, you can always in trying to create some non-understandable thing, you already have some conception of what a non-comprehensible thing would look like based on all the stuff you do understand.
So when the goddess of justice says, it is impossible because you cannot know what is not, nor can you express it, that's a really, I think, impossible. That's a really revolutionary idea that this, like, hey, like, negation, the negative, non-being, it's not really a thing. Like, there's no thingness there, there's no entity there. So you even acting like you can discuss it, can even think about it, you are wrong.
Yeah, this is really interesting too, especially if you think about the like Xenophanes, who says, oh, you know, the stuff about the gods, we can't really know about that, but and as far as other things, we can kind of approach it, or maybe. Parmenides is not talking about a gradation of, oh, if we try hard enough, we might figure this stuff out. This is a bifurcation of reality between it is, either you can talk about it or you can't. And if you can talk about it, then it can be said that it is. And if you can't talk about it, it can't be said that it's not.
We're no longer really talking about, you know, this or that being or these types of beings, or like you're talking these gradations of reality. We're talking about the concept of is, the concept of being, what there is and what there isn't. And what there isn't, we can't talk about.
Yeah, this is, you know, next to Heraclitus, who is also inaugurating a kind of ontology. This is an inauguration of what Western philosophy would go on to do as ontology. This is Heraclitus talking about the being of things. That for any given thing, it is. And for any given thing that isn't, well, it's not there to be discussed or to be known at all. One of the other things, too, that was emphasized in reading Charles Kahn's discussion of this is that what Parmenides is up to here is not just ontological, but it's interestingly epistemic, just from my translation. Then there's the way that it is not and that it must not be. This, as I show you, is an altogether misguided route, for you may not know what is not. There is no end to it, nor may you tell of it. I find this, the opening and closing of this particular fragment, how at the beginning she says, come then, I'll tell you. And do you, for your part, listen to my tale and pass it on. And then she also says at the end, nor may you tell of it. So there is this interest in, or this capacity for what is to be communicable, right? And this is another really interesting parallel with Heraclitus, who says that people who think they have understanding but turn into a private world, they don't really know reality. Well, they don't know reality because they don't know the common communicable logos, right? I don't know if I would go so far as to say he's equally as concerned with the logos or the legain of things being able to be talked about. That is certainly an element here, that the goddess intends what there is to be knowable. And what is knowable is communicable in a similar fashion to Heraclitus.
Parmenides is less concerned with like the logos being a sort of like having a definable character in this and that instance. Come now, I will tell you, and you must tell others. That there is obviously, when it comes to like this most basic conception of being, of, you know, what will eventually be called like the One. This is a very communicable thing. This is the truth, and the truth lies in something being able to be communicated and shared. And, you know, this is a bit of a cultural kind of musing on my part, but I also think it's a great sort of dividing line between what Parmenides was doing at the time and sort of other mystic traditions and pseudo-religious traditions that were going on, where there generally was a lot of kind of secretness and incommunicability, right? You know, you've got seers and mystics, and they have connections that, you know, you can't have and you can't know. And Parmenides is sort of saying, like, what I'm teaching here, what I'm talking about here, what was shared with me, this is accessible for all reasoning beings, right? You all understand this.
This is, I feel like I could read this as a response to the Pythagorean community as well, because the Pythagorean community was a secret community. You know, I think it was Aetius who says that they kept no ordinary silence. So that this is not just a private revelation, but it's a revelation that is communicable. And not only that, it's amenable to any intelligent being. It should just fall right into place if you understand it. That is quite revolutionary. And I'm saying that within the history of ideas as well, it's responsive to the secretness of the Pythagoreans. Just another way that Parmenides is incorporating Pythagorean ideas.
What you can speak of and think of has to be, since it can be, well, nothing cannot be. What you can speak of and think of has to be. It's really interesting how she emphasizes the goddess here. What you can speak of, again, just like we were saying, what you can speak of, i.e. shareable, communicable through any kind of reasoning being, and think of, again, that connection there, what's in your own mind, what you can actually sort of tease out through mental reason. It has to be, right? Those things, like, they obviously, you're talking about them, you're thinking about them, so they're there. And then she goes on to say, since it can be while nothing cannot be, right? There's no placeholder there for non-being.
Yeah, there is no such thing as nothing.
And in my translation, actually, it's funny, the next line is, think about that.
I have, these are the guidelines I suggest for you. So mine is a little bit more elegant, but I like yours.
Yeah, I like how the goddess sits there is like, I just said something really important. You think about that now.
Yeah, if you really think about it.
For that is the first way of thinking from which I hold you back. I also hold you back from the way on which mortals, knowing nothing, wander two-headed, helplessness guiding their wandering minds, that go along, both deaf and blind, in a daze, creatures without judgment, who think that to be and not to be are the same, yet not the same, and that the way of all things turns upon itself. For this shall never be proved, that things that are, not are. Do not take the way of thinking. Do not take that way of thinking. Do not let your habits born of long experience force thoughts in that direction. To travel with an aimless eye, droning ear and tongue. Rather, judge by your reason. The contentious refutation I have spoken. So a lot going on there in that section. We're introduced to this. So we mentioned earlier that there's two ways, right? That you know, what is and what is not, basically. But now there's actually kind of a third way that's revealed to us. This is the way of mortals. This is basically Parmenides is saying through the goddess that this, the way people normally actually think about the world, you know, if you ask them, okay, tell us the most basic stuff about the world, tell us the most basic stuff about existence, whatever, tell us the most basic stuff about thought, people would come up with this model that sort of conflates being and non-being.
Yeah, certain things are, well, at the same time are not. So things are hot, but hot implies cold. So something being hot is not cold. So it is and is not at the same. It's basically the realm in which duality
Yeah, and we could also think about things like creation and destruction, right? Like, you know, I have my crops, then my crops are gone. You know, I had my parents, then my parents are gone, right? Like, so they are and they are not, they were and then they weren't. Do not let your habits, born of long experience, force your thoughts in that direction. So basically, the Parmenides is at least through the goddess, saying there that this is what through habit is kind of brought up. This is how we're brought up to think. It's wrong. Like, it doesn't matter how much you think it seems like obvious to you through your own experience. You know, we're using reason to tease out, like, literally through, you know, logic, that this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, so two things that are really interesting here as well, and they have to do with the Greek. So to go to your point at the end there, but use reason to come to a decision on the contentious test I have announced. That word reason is actually logos. It's the same word that Heraclitus tells his readers / listeners to listen to. So Parmenides and Heraclitus, again, I'm drawing lots of parallels because I think that they are oftentimes put in contention when they're both responding to the same thing, that is reality. So it would make sense that they would come up with similar conclusions, but they're doing them in different ways, right? Heraclitus is saying, look, if you listen to the logos, it is wise to agree that things are and are not. But Parmenides is saying, listen to your reason and you'll realize that that doesn't make any sense, right? It only makes sense to take the first way. So there is, if we're going back to that, the ways, there is one way, the way of truth, and then there's the way of seeming, you know, this way that the many-headed, the indecisive herd go. It can seem like there's two ways, but if you think about it, that second way that we were talking about, that it is not and that it must not be, that isn't a way, because it is not. It doesn't exist. There is no second way that the goddess is talking about. It's just that second incomprehensible, it's not even a second incomprehensible way. It's just the limit that delineates what the first way is. So there, you know, there is like debate about, are there three ways? Are there two ways? There's two ways, but you only arrive at the first way by asking yourself, well, is it or is it not? And then you realize it is. And then you realize, okay, well, that's how you go about that way. What about this other way of seeming? The goddess is also going to say that you can go that way because it has some being. People are mistaken about what that way is. The other thing too, and to tie this back to Heraclitus, is that the end of that particular fragment, she uses the word palanthropos. In whose thinking being and not being are the same and yet not the same, for all of them the path turns back on itself. So that turning back on itself, that in Greek is palanthropos, it's the same word that Heraclitus uses in the fragment. They don't understand how agreeing with itself, it disagrees with itself. A back turning, a harmony that turns back on itself, like in the case of the bow and the lyre. If he is alluding to Heraclitus, and there is some discussion about, oh, did Heraclitus, who wrote first, Heraclitus or Parmenides, how are they responding to each other? Again, I think that it comes down to that they're both talking about the same thing. They're both trying to talk about ontology, so it would make sense that they would... And they're both speaking the same language, so it would make sense that they would pull on the same resources to talk about it. But there is that similarity where it's really interesting that despite using the same words, palanthropos and logos, they come to radically, radically distinct conclusions about the one.
With Parmenides' radically distinct conception of the one, maybe it's worth talking a little bit about basically the general idea that Parmenides is getting at, and most people get at, which is that Parmenides' vision of the world then is what we would generally call as being a kind of monism. That since basically, okay, you've got things that aren't, they are not. Okay, we could bracket that. We could push those aside.
We don't have to bracket anything. There isn't anything to bracket.
I shouldn't even said it like that. There are no brackets. There's nothing to put brackets around. There's nothing to say. We're moving on, right? That's basically goddess is like, think about that. Go. Then we've got the Way of Mortals, which confuses the two paths we were introduced to. It basically says, well, things are, and then they aren't, and then I think about stuff, and then it goes away, and it's basically Parmenides is saying, no, anything that is cannot go into any kind of non-existence, because non-existence is not a thing. But by extension, when we look at that, when we kind of flesh that out, differentiation is also not a thing, really, in the same kind of way, right?
Because in order to differentiate, you would have to say what something is not. And that's
exactly
there. And if being is, there is nothing to limit being from being, right?
And I think that, and that's where we, like with the last fragment we were talking about, it sort of says, you know, through habit, people come about like this different, like, you know, confusing isn't is not, like, don't do that. We think that we see different things. We think that we go through night, like kind of like introducing earlier. We think there's night and day. The sun comes up, the sun goes down, the moon comes up, the moon comes down, it gets dark, it gets light. You know, we think that there's night and day. We make that differentiation. Parmenides is basically saying, like, that's, coming back to epistemology, that's like basically an us problem, right? Like, that's a perceptual issue. But when you think about it logically, how could you make some sort of separation? Where is that separation? What is it really? And by extrapolation, you can do that with all entities, all beings. And so we end up in this monistic, you know, conceptual world where really the truth at bottom of all things is that all things are one. As he eventually says, like all thing just is.
Yeah.
Like there, it's just being.
There just is being. There is nothing that, because if you tried to have anything that, you know, like, say you're cutting a block of cheese and the knife cuts it. Well, that cheese and the knife are both being. It's just being. It's just being on being. There is no separation there. What could there be to differentiate two things? Because it would have to be to differentiate them so that it's just continuous with it.
The truth of the universe is that there's just one stuff. And And this is where Parmenides, he's so much more radical and, you know, we might also say logically committed than the other pre-Socratics. Like, you know, you were to talk about Aristophanes and Xenophanes and stuff like that from earlier on, where, you know, you're coming up with basically, oh, okay, well, there's all this like one substance, there's a primary substance, whether it's water or the unlimited, or, you know, Heraclitus even kind of brings in fire, although I think he's a little more tactful with that. But, you know, this is the primary stuff, and then it turns into other things, right? It's the base for other things to be. And Parmenides kind of points out, like, from his, you know, the perspective of reason, of using, you know, as the goddess has required of him, using only his reason, using only, you know, what we call logic, that, again, how could you say that it, you know, if everything is water, if water is the primary thing, but then, like, you're also saying that it becomes stone, that it becomes human being, that, like, how could that be? Like, how could you have that kind of separation? How could you have that kind of transition from it going from it is to it is not now this, or it is not whatever, right? So instead, everything just has, you have to be super consistent, right? Like, the reason is driving you to be really consistent. Everything is being, and that's it.
Yeah. There's a testimonia here in Simplicius's commentary on Aristotle's Physics. He's quoting Eudemus, another thinker, saying that for Parmenides would not agree with anything unless it seemed necessary, whereas his predecessors used to come up with unsubstantiated assertions. So Thales would speculate, and again, I think that it's worth, I mean, it's still really fascinating and important that the Milesians are inaugurating speculation about the cosmos, about the underlying harmony and order that structures the world. Parmenides gives it a radically distinct character, that it has to be necessary and it has to agree with thought itself. He's kind of squaring the mind against reality so that our way of thinking actually, not, it doesn't just speculate about or conform to the cosmos. In an important way, it is the cosmos. It's a shorter fragment, but it's one of the ones that people will remember most off from Parmenides. For the same thing both can be thought and can be. If you think, you know, think about it, if a thought is, it is being, so thought, well, there isn't thought to be differentiated from being, but if a being is a thought of what is, then your thought is what it is, right? Your mind actually, it doesn't just conform to reality, it is reality, because it isn't nothing, it's something, and so it's being.
Yeah, and so you have you're having the thought, it's there, right? You can't say it's just like gone back into non-existence. It has to be part of the whole. And there is no difference, like as you said, there's certainly no differentiation between, you know, the external and internal world.
Yeah.
Right? Like that, again, no, that's a separation.
That is a very later distinction that philosophers come up with. Here, we are seeing kind of if we can see it as living in, you know, the world of Descartes, we can see this as Parmenides establishing some kind of connection. For Parmenides, he's describing what is. He's inaugurating the insight, the revelation that the goddess is giving to him, that thought and being are.
There's a couple different ways of thinking about what is, also using the term it, like we know when it is and can be, or it is not and cannot be. There's been a lot of discussion about what, like, the, when we talked about, when Parmenides is talking about it, what does he mean there? And I think there's two, like, main ways of thinking about that. One of them is thinking about it in terms of, like, what is the monistic total of everything, right? Of just being generally. There's also a way of thinking about it that what the term it is used as kind of like a placeholder for variables, which Parmenides just wasn't using or didn't have access to at that time, where it basically is like, with this kind of thinking, you can basically put anything in there that you want, like yourself, that tree, you know, your thoughts, someone else's previous existence, your dead grandpa, like it is, right? And you can use it as a placeholder variable and say, anything that you can bring up, like literally anything that you can think of, anything that is or will be, like can fit in there. And because it is, right? Like you can use that formula anywhere you want, and you can never take it and plug it into the other side of thought, which is why it's impossible, right? You can never plug it into it is not and cannot be, yeah. Right?
Yeah, it's interesting. So two things on that. I think you're absolutely right that Parmenides is sort of discovering the proposition form that words have structures, and that structure holds for all things that are. So the other thing too is that in the Greek, there's actually just one word there, SD. In English, we have to supply the pronoun it. So when we ask what is it, we should be careful about asking, okay, well, what is Parmenides talking about when he says it? I think that because the verb has to refer to something. And even in his time, people were asking, okay, well, what is he referring to when he says SD? But we should just be careful that he's like, sometimes we go chasing words when there aren't really words there. But I do think that what he's talking about is there. And I think that's captured when you say that he's describing, he's giving an early description of the propositional form itself, that you can put anything there.
I think it's worth emphasizing, you know, just how revolutionary Parmenides is in a kind of, I want to say academic, but that's not right, but a more professional aspect of philosophy, where you really start to see a lot of these sort of ontological and logical concepts being brought up in Parmenides in their earliest form, right? These sort of necessities of thought.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is the key word, is necessities, right? Parmenides is laying down rules for how to engage with himself, right? Heraclitus is also coining terms. He is talking about the logos. He is talking about what's common. He is referring to harmonia and whatnot. But Parmenides, with Heraclitus, people called him and lampooned him as the obscure and the dark philosopher. They didn't know how to be in common with him and use his words. He kind of expected you to figure it out. And if you didn't, well, tough luck. But with Parmenides, it's like a gossamer. It's completely transparent to anyone who uses language, who contemplates in a kind of eternal way that being is, and the enormously, it's unintuitive because he's taking that term and using it in an enormously general form. I mean, we would say universal, right? This is, I wonder if this is the, it probably isn't the first universal, but something like that is being inaugurated here. And I think that's probably what you're referring to when you talk about it being sort of academic. I think it's technical in that sense.
Unlike Heraclitus, who seems to have a lot of contempt for the general populace and even his readership, he's not out there being like, I want everyone to join me in the truth. We got to figure it out. But Parmenides is really, I think, first of all, there's an almost kind of like democratic or populist aspect of Parmenides where he's basically like, everybody can do this, right? Like, the gods have come to me. They've shown me the true way of thinking, the reality of knowing the universe, and they've told me to share it. You all have there's an aspect, I think, like, it's potentially, you all have the aspect to understand this, and also this was something that was performed, that was shown, like, you know, quite widely, and it's seemingly, from what we know, quite intentional. Thinking about just a little bit later with Socrates and Plato, you know, Parmenides shows up as a character in Plato's dialogues, right, especially the later ones, and it's really interesting to see Parmenides there, because obviously we're not going to talk too much about the work that's titled Parmenides. Parmenides is one of the only characters in all of Plato's corpus that is able to effectively best Socrates and give real serious criticisms of Plato's own sort of formulations and own ideas within the context of a dialogue. Now, obviously that's not Parmenides actually speaking, that's Plato using him as a character. But what I think it shows is how much Plato, and probably his contemporaries as well, respected Parmenides as a serious philosopher, as a serious thinker. Like, this guy, like, he was kind of, you could think, he was kind of like the OG. He was the original philosopher, and he's the only one of the very few that will ever show up and be like, I know better than you.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Soca's first and second year social is happening soon. Join us at Soca, the Students of Caribbean and African Ancestry, in the Student Union Building, room 1430, on Friday, October 4th, from 5 p.m. onwards. This event is for the first and second years to meet and connect with new friends. All are welcome. See you there.